Okay, it's getting close to the start of this afternoon's meditation class. So those of you who are attending the introduction to meditation class, the series of four classes, for those who are beginning the journeys of meditation, that is happening in the room to my right, over there. And that is just to get you going in meditation. Sometimes what happens is often focus on just one part of meditation, and then we do a 45-minute meditation, which is a bit long for many people. So sometimes it's great for those who are beginning in meditation to actually to attend the class in the room on my right. And later on, after finishing the basic four parts of the meditation class, then we can actually come here and just continue on. So I think most people are here now, except for my monks who are busy talking over there. Yes, can you kindly... I remind. He's not. Oh, he's not coming for the meditation anyway. Okay. Okay. Lynn. Okay, you can tell him not to come. And then you can come in. And I thought he was. Was he? No. He's going now. Okay, whatever. Okay. Anyway. For those who want to do some meditation today, thank you, Lynn. Anyway, yes, very good. He's already way past the advanced stage. So one of the nice things about meditation is it does create a beautiful, peaceful mind, energizes the mind, brings good health. But the way we meditate, if we do use too much force in meditation, what happens is that the mind gets stressed and the body gets stressed as well. And it's one thing that we should know, that the stress is something which meditation is supposed to be overcoming, getting past. And years ago when I went to teach in Malaysia, people over there were complaining about what they called meditation headache. And to me that was just so weird. I'd never heard that before, ever. Because usually you use meditation to overcome things like headaches and pain, to really relax. And this particular, it took a long time for me to investigate why this was happening. One thing about meditation, we always just try and find out why these things are occurring. And it was, people were using what we call a meditation on the breath, on the breathing. And they were taught to focus on the tip of the nose. And if you focus on the tip of the nose when you're meditating, which you know, some teachers recommend, now you find even if you have your eyes closed, what happens when you've got your eyes closed and you focus your mind on the tip of the nose is your eyes go there as well. So I'm going to take my glasses off, as I usually do when I demonstrate this point. If I kept my eyes open when I'm focusing on the tip of the nose, I focus now the breath on the tip of my nose, and my eyes go down there as well. And my eyeballs start to focus on the tip of the nose. And if I do this for half an hour, cross-eyed, with my eyeballs focusing on the tip of the nose, I too will get a headache across here. So that was one of the reasons why people were struggling, they were forcing. And when you force the mind, it does get tense, obviously. So instead, we do what we call letting go in this meditation. And when you let go, now you find your mind, you achieve the end of like being still, being focused, being peaceful, but not through force. You achieve it through letting go. And done this many times as well. The only way I can keep this water perfectly still is not by holding it and concentrating and really trying hard for this not to move. The only way to get water like this to be perfectly still is again to let it go. Put it down and it becomes still all by itself. That is the way we meditate. Even years ago, I remember, many years ago this is, and my teacher Ajahn Chah, he would sometimes just hold up his hand and he would wave it up and down. And he said, this represents a leaf on a tree during the wind. It moves up and down, not because that's its natural state. Something outside of it is making it move up and down, the wind. Once the wind stops, then that leaf will move less and less and less until it will become perfectly still all by itself. That's its natural state of being. What we call these days its default state. It's still. It doesn't need to be held still. It just needs to be protected from winds. And he said that's the same as a human mind. The human mind is naturally still. There's only something outside of it makes it move. What makes it move is called the winds of wanting. Wanting something makes your mind move. So part of the meditation is learn how to relax, not to want anything, just to be here. And one of the ways of letting go of wanting, I'm not saying you're not going to want anything for the rest of your life. It's just doing a meditation to get a break from all this trying to change things. One of the sayings which I really appreciate was, when you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. So when we want something more, we're not looking, we're not appreciating what we already have. We want to improve it, get more. And that is one of the problems why we get stressed. So imagine for 45 minutes when we're meditating, we're not looking for anything more. We're happy with what we have. Letting go of wanting, of changing, never thinking you're not good enough or this is not good enough. Being content. That contentment is another word for the opposite of wanting. We don't want something, we're content with what we have. But say, well, we'll never get anywhere that way. Precisely. You're not supposed to get anywhere. You're supposed to be where you already are. And appreciate, it's more than good enough here. Over in the Jhana Grove Retreat Center, there's a cartoon. There's so much wisdom comes from cartoons. And one of those lovely pieces of wisdom was with, this is going off on a tangent a little bit. So that's why I love sort of watching, looking at, not the movie cartoons, but on the newspapers, the cartoons. There was Snoopy, the dog, and his friend Charlie Brown in the Peanuts cartoon. And Charlie Brown said, one day we're all going to die. And can you argue with that? That is human wisdom. Dog wisdom is much superior. That Snoopy said, yes, but most days we don't die. And I thought, that's a wonderful positive attitude. Yeah, one day you're going to die, but most days you don't. But in this particular cartoon, there was this angry man was going towards the monk, really upset. And instead of speaking, had a big sign, a protest sign, I want happiness. And the monk said, give me that sign. And he said, your first mistake, I. Get rid of the ego, the sense of self. You won't get happy if it's all about you. So he rubbed out the I. And that left want happiness. Second mistake, want. So you scrub that out. So what's left? Happiness. That was a very profound little teaching, which is so true, that if you want peace, happiness, you find you miss it every time. But if you let go of the I, let go of the want, all you're left with is contentment. And the interesting thing in meditation, when you let go of wanting, put things down, that gets more and more still the longer I leave it. Your mind gets more and more still the longer you leave it. And that stillness is not something which is boring, but it builds up the energy, builds up the power. In the mindfulness movements, which you see often in today's world, the mindfulness is very just basic mindfulness. But if you add the stillness, then after a while that mindfulness really starts to get empowered. And you can do those things. Sometimes what happens, you're just sitting here, just being still, not wanting anything in the whole world. Just being content. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. You're enjoying this moment. Being at peace with it. And that peace builds up so you're more and more and more aware of what's happening. Some of you may have experienced these phenomena. You, after a good meditation, you go outside, and the leaves are greener than you've ever seen before. The flowers are just more rich in colour. And even the clouds in the sky which have amazing formations. And this is where a poem by the 17th century British poet and painter William Blake, "To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." To see a world in a grain of sand, your mind is so still, so peaceful, that you can see things which other people can't. You're empowered, your senses are strong. And that's what happens with meditation. When you become still, you become very alert, very mindful, and you start to see more and more beauty in the world. It's not anything which is crazy, or it's just a natural phenomena. How it works is, it's just one way of explaining this. There are two parts to the human mind, and I call one is called the doer, the other one is the knower. And the knower is like mindfulness, awareness. The doer is you're always thinking and reacting and planning and remembering. The mind is always active. And that uses up most of the energy of your body. I think I eventually found out, I knew it was a large proportion of your intake of energy, food, drink. A large part of that, 20% of that, is used by your brain. If you ever see the size of the brain, it's really small. That uses up a large proportion of your intake of energy, much more than you'd expect, proportionate to its size. Imagine if you didn't use that brain. In a sense, you kept it still, not working, not thinking, not worrying, not anxious, not planning. Imagine where all that energy would go. It would go into what we call the knowing. Because you're not thinking, you're not planning, you're not worrying. You find the mind energizes. It goes into knowing. The awareness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And that becomes really cool to experience that. So it comes by the fact that you just don't do anything. It's after a while when you see it, you experience it, it's obvious. You're actually preserving your energy, keeping it, building up, So your mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And the other thing, when it gets stronger and stronger and stronger, you're really aware, you find whatever you see is beautiful, is gorgeous. And I cannot avoid telling one of the grossest anecdotes I can ever say. I've said it many times, many of you know what's coming. It's when I was teaching a retreat at Jhana Grove some years ago. And when I teach meditation, I always do meditation as well. I had a very, very beautiful deep meditation. And after the meditation, just full of energy and happiness, really powerful mindfulness. And I had to go to the toilet. And when I went to the toilet in Jhana Grove to do what they say in Australia is a number two, I made the mistake of before I flushed the toilet, I had a look into the toilet bowl to see what I'd just given birth to. And when I looked in there, I've never seen in my whole life such a beautiful piece of feces. Many of you sometimes think it's just yucky, but if you really examine it, look at it, there's so many different shades of brown. And, you know, it's not just just one colour, one tint. The whole lot is so many different, and the way it interacts together, you know, like the colours when they actually work together, it just one enhances the other. And then I sort of started looking at the sculpture, the way it's formed, sort of interacted, all these balls stuck together in a way like Michelangelo or Rodin would actually do. And it was delightful. And then I started to contemplate and explore the aroma. The aroma, I mean, come on. Sometimes so many of the scents and perfumes are just so false, fake and plastic. This was real. This was spoke about life itself. And I really got high on this. And I was looking at it going, wow, this is amazing. The most beautiful piece of shit I've ever seen in my life. And honestly, I did contemplate for, you know, a minute, picking it out to show my friends. I decided that was a bit gross. But then the hardest thing was, walking away. That was very difficult. Walking away from the most beautiful turd I've ever seen in my life. But the only reason I could do that, was because of my training in letting go. A monk for 44 years, being able to renounce. But still it was difficult to press that button at the top. But I did it. But the point of the whole story, it's gross, it's memorable, but it was true that even something as, disgusting as that looked so beautiful and aromatic when you had deep meditation. Afterwards, the energy was so strong, everything was appreciated. Now that's one of the things which happens in meditation. Something which is empowering your mind, making it very beautiful, very peaceful, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, when you never thought you'd ever could do this. An eternity, timelessness in the hour. Beautiful. So, stillness is not something which is boring. Yeah, you may get a bit sleepy at first, but you carry on. The energy is building up. You're just paying off the debts of tiredness, of overactivity. But after a while, the energy returns, and you find the mind is just so bright and so peaceful. Well, it is so bright and peaceful. So relaxed, there's not an ounce of tension there. You can know that one of the usual tests is trying to insult somebody and they just don't react. When the guitar string, as I was saying last week, is so loose, there's no tension, nothing pulling it at all. Something hits it and there's no resonance. The guitar string is tight. Something hits it, it really makes a sound. So loosen the strings of your life. Relax. Energize. And you find you have a beautiful mind. Okay, so let's get going with the meditation. I will lead it for about 15-20 minutes, maybe more, and then I will let go and allow you just to go deeper in the meditation, to be as still as possible, to learn how to let go, no wanting, and then you're peaceful. And I should say once again, because some people came in late, that if you come for meditation for the first time, the introduction to meditation class is in the room on my right. So this is for those who are the experts, or sort of, near enough. So if you'd like to sit down, get yourself comfortable, oh by the way, don't do that thing with the feces, because if somebody, there's only a few toilets in this Buddhist center, so if you're in there going, wow, 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 look at that, then you block up the toilet for such a long time. And we've also got health surveyors here from Perth City, so you better be careful. Don't take it out, otherwise we'll get sued. So, relax. And with your eyes closed, start to bring your awareness, your attention to your body. First of all, is the building up your awareness and your stillness. You feel the body with your mind. How are your legs? One effective way to be mindful is to ask questions of your body, say, how are you, body? How are you, legs? Now straight away, direct your attention to that part of your body. When you have your attention to that part of the body, then you're aware of it. Once you've got the information, the data, how your body is, or especially your legs, then don't just stop there, be kind. Is there anything you need, legs? Do you need to be adjusted or scratched or moved? And you can always just experiment. Try this, try that. Because when you move and adjust, you'll find you'll get a different sensation. It's called feedback. And that feedback will allow you to know whether you're in a better position or should go back to the first one. You're becoming aware and kind enough to adjust your legs into the best possible position so that you can meditate for 45 minutes with no aches or pains, or minimal aches or pains. Then having adjusted your legs, then go to your butt. I was just adjusting my bottom a few seconds ago to get it just right on the cushion. Fidget now and get enlightened later. If you don't fidget now, you fidget later, you'll never get peaceful. I'm aware of my butt, making sure it's in the best possible position. And then move up to my back, finding out what is the best position. Move it a bit this way, move it a bit that way to find if it is the best. And look at my hands. Feel them. How do you feel down there, hands? Are you okay? You can move them this way, move them that way. Until I feel that that's comfortable. I can maintain that position. Then I moved up to my shoulders, loosening the muscles in the shoulders. The tight muscles there create aches later on. So again, just like the simile of a string, I try to imagine those muscles stretched on both ends, like a bunch of strings being pulled apart. That's called stress. Imagine letting go of both ends. Letting go of both ends. And to feel the muscles become comfortable and at ease. Then go up to my neck, just sweeping up the body little by little to make sure the head is properly positioned. Too far forward, too far back will create tension in the muscles of my neck and pain later. And also my throat, say fever season. And sometimes that creates an irritation in the throat. So make sure I spend a little time soothing my throat, wishing it well. How do you do that? Try this, try that, trial and error, until you learn from the feedback offered by mindfulness. Then I go up to my face, relaxing the muscles around the eyes and the mouth. I'm not watching the breath or trying to do anything, it's just being here, learning how to relax. And feeling the effects of relaxation. Things becoming smooth, open and comfortable. imagine just going 2 inches behind my eyes, centering my mindfulness there in the middle of my brain. Even though you're not supposed to have any sensations in the brain, I imagine that brain overworked, tired. Relax it. Just the same way that you relax the rest of your body. Aware, getting feedback, and imagining your brain taking a rest. No one pushing it, demanding results. No one wanting to change. Just being as it is, creating peace inside your brain. Then I imagine my whole body, from the toes to the head, relaxed to the max. And now as one unit. And hopefully you can notice the delight of relaxation, where the body feels at peace, pleasurably at peace. Because noticing delight is a way of increasing mindfulness and relaxation. You go deeper. It also helps you be content. When you're content, the wanting subsides. Then I go to my mind, by which I mean the peaceometer, first of all. How peaceful am I? How agitated? Giving it a number from 1 to 10. Just as a means to be aware of how peaceful or how agitated I am. And I notice what makes my mind more peaceful. What moves the needle of the peaceometer closer to 1? What moves the needle of the peaceometer up towards 10, more disturbed, more agitated? I often find that it's wanting, desire, not being happy being here, that causes just more disturbance. Just being content with where I am, with what I have. Not wanting anything more. I can enjoy what I have. It may not be the best, but this is good enough. Just being here. And I notice that the peaceometer gets closer and closer to 1. Deep peace. And it's quite natural that sometimes we just become aware of the breath. We don't want to become aware of the breath or not want it. Just there. Just happy to be in this moment with the breath. No past, no future. Not trying to get somewhere. Not trying to attain things. That's what you do in life, in job, in work. Here, this is relaxation, rest. It's going inside, not getting on. And I notice when I build up more and more contentment with my breathing, with my mind, not wanting anything, then I can stay here. The wind is not blowing on the leaf. The mind becomes peaceful. I'm now going to be quiet until the end of the meditation. getting close to the end of this meditation session. How do you feel? What's it like in your mind? How relaxed is your body? How energized is your mind? And why? As we learn from every meditation. Three times to end today's meditation session. Very good. So now we have the usual questions and answers. So has anyone got any questions from here, group here? Okay, see what we've got from the internet. Okay, here we go. Today from Amsterdam, from England, and from Germany. Okay, so general question first of all from Amsterdam. I struggle to find the balance between my Buddhist principles and being normal. My friend told me he wants me to talk more and insult him from time to time. But I've been trying to talk less and be nice over the past years. What do I do? Oh, I think you can stand your ground and just be kind. At least, you know, sometimes being normal. What is normal? Again, I recall being a Buddhist when I was at university, giving up alcohol, being a vegetarian, just not doing anything which was certainly not abusing people and insulting anybody. And from those times, that after we left university and went our separate ways, I did ask my friends for feedback. What did you think of me being a Buddhist? That was in 1972. And they said, oh, we didn't mind you being a Buddhist because you still join in with everything we did. You know, you go to the pub and have an orange juice. You just go to the parties, you know, but just never get drunk. And, you know, they said that you were the person they could always rely upon to drive them home if they were drunk. And that what they really did like was that I never pushed my views or beliefs on them. That I was just joining in whatever they did, and I didn't flaunt my Buddhist principles. Which means that they were quite happy. Just so you can stand your ground, you become a useful person in your group of people. You don't need to insult people to become welcome. So being normal, you're better than normal. So anyway, I would actually find the balance between my Buddhist principles and being normal. You have to be who you are. You can't just suddenly decide, you know, your Buddhist principles are not relevant anymore. Because if you are, or if you think one thing and you behave a different way, that's a lot of psychological stress. So You can talk more if you need to. I'm a Buddhist. I talk a lot. It's my job. So you can talk, but you don't insult anybody. One thing to do is always be, not being normal, but being compassionate. And being compassionate is to try and meet them without breaking your principles, and to join in with stuff, but not going too far. In England, I see spirits and ghosts when I meditate. Oh, that's good fun. I just ignore them, but one lay down next to me, and it's freaking me out. I would like to know how to stop them so I can enjoy meditating again. I tried chanting and blessed water. There was this gentleman who I know very well. He was a monk, but he disrobed. And he told me, when he was still a monk, that he was meditating in a monastery in Thailand, famous for its monks, for its ghosts, sorry, a well-known ghost monastery. And he said that he was meditating, and after a while he got tired. He was leaning against the wall, and he had his legs out, and just to stretch them, and a bit dozy, and he felt something pulling his foot. First of all, he thought it was like a heavenly being trying to wake him up and make him meditate more. So he almost like thanked it and just crossed his legs and meditated a bit longer. But then that was just the start of a being coming in and disturbing him, just sometimes poking him, sometimes just pushing him. And after a while, he got a bit fed up on this, and he knew it was a ghost because after a while, it would always come in with an unpleasant smell. And, ghosts don't have unpleasant smells. Because ghosts have the unpleasant smells. Heavenly beings have very pleasant smells. So anyway, after a while, he noticed the ghost was coming. It was really disturbing him. So he resolved the problem with one day he could smell the ghost coming into his hut. And he scolded the ghost. "Ghost! You sit down here and meditate or get out." Very firm. And at that, the ghost left and never came back. He was being firm. And the reason I say this is because that is one way to deal with ghosts. You can be kind, compassionate to ghosts, but sometimes the kindness maybe doesn't really work. Sometimes you have to be firm. And that is understanding that ghosts are actually lower beings. Human beings are higher beings. Sometimes I don't understand why human beings are afraid of ghosts. Sometimes why? It's like the best simile is, why are elephants afraid of mice? An elephant can squash a mouse just like that, but the elephants are afraid of mice. Same as human beings are afraid of ghosts. So if you do encounter a ghost, you tell it what to do. You say, "You meditate, behave, or out of here." And the ghosts usually go. But if you really, really, really just want to... what's that other story? If you really sort of want to make use of the ghost, you'd ask the ghost first of all, "Can you have some lottery numbers, please? Or who's going to win the Melbourne Cup?" That was a long time ago, so that doesn't work now. Because apparently they're really good at knowing the lottery numbers, ghosts. So ask the lottery numbers first, and then say, "Go!" But that sort of being firm with ghosts actually does work, because the other anecdote, I do many funerals, obviously, as part of my job, and that there was a Chinese funeral at, it was Fremantle Cemetery. And so, all the members of the family assemble there and the hearse arrives. And it was a burial. And I know where the Chinese cemetery is. It's a long way. So, it's a long way from the gate. We usually have to walk in procession, from the gate, the entrance, to the gravesite. So I knew it was a long way, and I was walking up front. And so I knew it was going to take about 10 or 15 minutes to get there. So I just had a conversation with the funeral director, who was a woman. I asked her, I said, how long have you been doing this job? I said, oh, maybe about 20 years now. I'm going to retire in another sort of couple of months. I said, oh, great. What, have you any ghost stories? You know, just a way to pass the time as I walk into the gravesite. And said, oh, yeah. He said, what's some of your best ones? And she said that often she sees the ghost in the funeral home. And so, well, you know, because there's lots of, they keep the coffins there with the corpses in before they actually bury them in the freezer. And so she says often she's working there in the office, and sometimes late at night or in the afternoon, and she sees the ghosts walk past. And she recognizes them because, you know, she embalms them and just puts them in the box. And she says as soon as she sees the ghost walk past, she scolds her, hey, you! Get back in your box. And that's how she scolded by the box, he meant the coffin. So get back in your box, you. So, and if you don't believe in ghosts, I remember just one of my really good interfaith friends was Abbot Placid of the New Norcia Monastery. He passed away some time ago. If you've ever seen the monastery up in New Norcia, you know, it's just one of the oldest buildings. And so when he was taking me around for a guided tour, I asked him, said, are there any ghosts in this New Norcia monastery? And he replied, I'm a Catholic. The Catholics don't believe in ghosts. And I said, what about the Holy Ghost? Just joking with him. So anyway, if you see spirits, ghosts when you meditate, you just tell them what to do. You don't need to freak out, otherwise they'll take advantage of you. You tell them what's what. That's your space. Go, you meditate, or get back in your box, or go somewhere. Be firm. And from Germany, I've recently had part of a lung removed. I find it hard to breathe. Have you any suggestions that will make it easier for me to relax? Yeah, sure. It's, you know, you are breathing. And remember, you've only got sort of half a lung. So if you really sort of sit down and become still, you don't need so much oxygen. So obviously that means that half a lung will be able to manage. So it should be quite easy to meditate, because when you're meditating, you know, obviously you're not exerting yourself. You're not sort of metabolizing that much. So it should be very easy. You don't need so much oxygen to lessen the oxygen demand on your lungs. So one lung should easily be able to manage it. When you're out walking or something, obviously that is a bit of a different case. But at least you can have some relief when you're meditating. Very often that when people do meditate, that they have sometimes get so quiet, so still, that, you know, basically nothing much is happening. It's just like a car which is parked in the garage. It doesn't need much fuel, which means that the oxygen supply is very, very light. So you can feel that. You breathe really, really lightly, hardly much breath going in at all. You don't force it. It's just natural. So that's one of the reasons why it's quite a good thing to meditate and just reduce your demand for oxygen. So it should be very easy to relax when you meditate. Relax. If you find it just a little bit uncomfortable at first, you try just to make peace, be kind, be gentle with whatever you feel. Just don't try and force it. Just make peace with it. Be with it. And be kind. Because when you're kind, you don't have fear. Then it just relaxes the body a lot. And you find that that's another way to relax. Okay, anything from here? Any ghost questions? Any questions from the spirit world? Yes? Oh, not a ghost question. Okay, go on.
I've not been able to find a middle ground between either my mind racing around in the past and the future, or becoming very still and then actually falling.
Yeah.
I think, falling asleep.
Yeah.
And I suspect I just can't.
Ah, okay.
I can't calm and then stay focused. It's either running around and thinking about things awake,
yeah,
or I'm falling asleep, one of the two.
Yeah. Please fall asleep. That's much better than activating the mind. Because you fall asleep and then it soon vanishes and disappears. So many years I was meditating in Thailand, and in the morning I'd always fall asleep. And I thought, I tried really hard to stay awake. Mm. But then again, you were restless. You're either restless, thinking, or falling asleep. So first of all, one day when I went to Bangkok to do my visa, and there was a monastery I stayed at, quite wealthy, it was a royal monastery, where the kings of Thailand would ordain. And at that monastery, they had one of the first air-conditioned rooms in Bangkok. And because we get up early at 3 a.m., we got permission to get the key so we could use it. So at 3 a.m. in Bangkok, with, you know, decent food, not sort of the very, very malnourished, unsustainable food which I was eating in the northeast, good food, good rest, an air-conditioned room, the sleepiness vanished. You can meditate so easily. It was just a physical problem. And I thought, you know, if the Buddha was English, was meditating in the jungles, he would have fallen asleep as well. Because it was a physical thing. And from that you realize a lot that much of the sleepiness is physical. You know, you haven't slept well last night. You know, you're tired, it's the wrong climate, you haven't eaten properly or something. It's a physical thing. So first of all, don't be ashamed about it. It's just natural. So afterwards, once you sort of, you've had your little sleep, then you find out that after the sleep, the sleepiness slowly vanishes like a mist lifting in the early morning sun. You're just mindful and kind. You don't fight the sleepiness. You be with the sleepiness. Just embrace it, accept it. And then your energies start to come. The mist lifts. And then when you're awake, you're not restless. You're peaceful. So that was the way through that. I was fighting my tiredness. When I fought the tiredness, then I became restless. I suppressed the restlessness and now I was sleepy again. So instead I accepted the sleepiness and it lifted gently. And then you were awake, clear, peaceful, poised in that beautiful position between restlessness and sleepiness. That's the way to do it.
Sounds beautiful. I'll try it. Thank you.
Very good. Okay. So now we can just pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can go and do what we need to do.